So when Tim and I decided to do these paramis, we were picking our months, and we were going two and two. And Tim looked up, and he didn't have a summer, basically. And so he said, he asked me if I would take August, so he could take August off. But it pretty much means you're going to have all Tim for the rest of the year, pretty much, till December. And I said, sure, this is resolve. I know that. I can do resolve. It seemed, out of all the paramis, it seemed that that's my practice, resolve. So I had this kind of typical for me to have a preset way of what I thought resolve was. So I looked up, you know, I always look up these words in the dictionary, because in the dictionary is more the way I think of resolve. But I think as we go through the evening, you're going to find that, yeah, it's not that way. So when I looked in the dictionary for resolve, it said to find an answer or to a solution to something, you know, resolution, to get something settled and resolved. That sounds like what I thought. To make a definite and serious decision about something, kind of like a formal decision or like when you're voting or something. That's the way I thought of it, kind of this, I'm gonna do it. That's what the whole thing is. And another, sometimes the word determination is interchanged with this idea of resolve. And so I looked up determination. It says that it's a quality that makes you continue trying to do something or achieve something that's difficult. That sounds like resolve to me. A quality that makes you continue doing, trying to do something or achieve something that's difficult. Or an act of finding out or calculating about something. And the act of officially deciding to do something. Start out on the path, resolve. And all of those pretty much sounded like, yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. That's what I thought resolve was. And that's the way I was going to pretty much approach it. But our English, as usual, has some limiting factors. And when I started actually reading the commentaries and different people's expression of resolve, I think it's a little different than that. I think it's not quite so hard, fast rule like that. Like some of the words that are similar to resolve or determination is like firmness or firm, this unwavering. There's even a granite, like a stone stuck. We're not moving off of this purposefulness and this kind of stick-to-itness. That's what I sort of thought resolve is. I thought that is what I have done over 25 years, this kind of firm stick-to-itness and, you know, purposeful practice. But, you know, I mean, over the course of 25 years, my practice has been kind of ugly at times, kind of hard and non-existent and very haphazard at times, and it's just been all over the place. But I thought the resolve was that toughness I had about practice. The word makes, I think, is what is the trouble. It's this idea that we make ourselves do something. We make something, that we make this practice be a certain way. And that word make is kind of the problem that I think we're going to see over the time. It's not a making. And I think when I look back on my practice, some of the problems I had was when I was trying to make myself see something, do something that really is not directed the way Dhamma is. Actually, almost anti-Dhamma. It probably interrupted my ability to practice because I was so set on it being a certain way, and I'm trying to make the practice go that way. It's not going. That's one thing good about the Dhamma. It's not going. No matter how much you try to push it, if it's not Dhamma, it's not going. So the Pali word for resolve, I think it's pronounced Aditana. It's Adi, which stands for higher, further, or fuller. That's the three ways I've heard people, I've read people. Higher, further, or fuller. And the tana is defined as a foundation or a standing place. So it's like you're standing on something and it makes for a fuller or higher or kind of further understanding. So I think it's less about force and more about the fullness of our understanding, the quality, that fuller nature of our realizations or comprehension. The more fuller, the more far-reaching our comprehension, our understanding, the deeper our resolve. So one definition I read said that resolve is thinking in ways that lead to well-being, which is a kind of a weird thing to me because I never really associated resolve with thinking. But a little bit later, you know, that's one of the ways Joseph Goldstein explains it. So it's really quite interesting, this concept, this parami of resolve and the way that we work with it. Seems to be two words that are closer to the connection of what resolve is. Two words. Intention, like right intention or right thinking. It's not so much what we do, it's the motivation before it. So you could think of resolve as our motivation behind the actions. It's the idea of beginning again. So I want to read a couple of ways that, two different ways. This is Pema Chodron. I have so many quotes from Pema Chodron because I think, when I think of resolve, that's Pema Chodron right there. So she says that we think the point is to pass the test or overcome the problem. But the truth is that things don't really get resolved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together again and they fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all this to happen. Room for grief, room for release, relief, room for misery, room for joy. It seems nice, this idea that there's a coming together and a falling apart, and a coming together and a falling apart. If we think about the way we sit, that's almost what happens. You know, at first you're sitting, you're still, it's good, then you're lost in thought. Then you come back to the sitting, it's still, it's good, then you're lost in thought. And it's just this kind of constant coming back to the practice, more so than it is this resolve to never get distracted. This idea that I'm not going to get distracted, I'm not going to think anymore, is less effective or skillful than just the idea that you just keep coming back, just keep coming back. But Ajahn Chah, I think, points to this a little differently. I think it's the same thing, but he says it in a completely different way. He says, I am like a tree in the forest. Birds come to the tree, they sit on its branches and eat its fruits. To the birds, the fruit may be sweet or sour, or whatever. The birds say sweet, or they say sour. But from the tree's point of view, this is just chatter of birds. Can you see a similarity? It's sort of like it's this, it's that, it's this, it's that. But there's a resolve that it's just being present to whatever it is, being open, as Pema Chodron was saying, to whatever shows up. It's that openness and that ability to create and give space that I think ultimately this resolve is. So I think that's what all the paramis, even in resolve, it's more about our seeing and less about our doing. More about what we can become aware of and less about this kind of making ourselves do something. So tonight, I'd like to discuss this idea of resolve from two ways of looking at it. One is just looking at our intention. So if we just looked at what's the motivation behind everything that we do, and the other way would be what's our thinking like around practice and the way we live, and see if we just look at the nature of resolve, not so much about the practices, we'll talk about that the next time, but right now, just the nature of it, what would it look like around our right intention or right thinking? So let's start with intention. I really just don't think it was happenstance that this paramis comes after truthfulness. It seems like if we're going to start getting truthful with what we see in the way that we are, with practice in our lives, this whole thing, we got this big, huge practice. After all this assumptions and beliefs around practice and what we think it is, what we think we're going to do, and you become, as you start getting more and more and more truthful to how you're actually expressing the Dhamma, how you're actually expressing your practice, how you're actually living out your practice, you start seeing a lot of this beliefs and assumptions and things that you have, this expectation. It's not so much that the motivation, intention is conscious, it's more unconscious. But we can see it if we begin to look at what we're actually doing, the truth of what we're actually doing. It's sort of like the seeing that helps us see the motivation and the intention behind it. So I used to have this assumption that practice, that somehow or another, I mean, I think a lot of us, you may be like me, we stumbled into this practice because everything else we tried didn't work. It was almost like this was the last straw. This is the last thing I'm going to try, because the idea of just sitting and doing nothing doesn't seem like it could possibly fix the mess of a life that I had. At least for me, it didn't seem like there's no way this is going to fix this, me. But I had tried everything else, and none of that worked. So I kind of like stumbled into this practice as a way to fix myself. And I carried that assumption that this practice was going to fix me for a long, 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 long time. Basically, I never questioned that idea, that I had that assumption. But every time I would sit down, I had this expectation that I had to somehow see that this practice was working. And if it's working, I should be better, nicer, happier, everything should be going good. And so I think that's the making aspect of this practice. I try to make myself look like I thought the practice was supposed to be. I think I told you guys that when I first moved back home and my mother would see that I would sit for 45 minutes, she would tell all her friends, I cannot believe that Dee Dee just sits still and she's so quiet. This is just the best ever. And she would come in, you know, and check to see if I was sitting still. What she didn't know is I would sit there, and then if I, you know, I'm thinking and daydreaming and, you know, not really paying attention, looking off into the space. But then if I'd hear my mother open that door, I'd be like, ah. all steady, and my mother would be creeping around the room, and then she would leave and maybe come back a little later, but every time she would come back, I'd be steady. When she was gone, I was like, ah, oh, I don't know what I'm doing this thing. But I had this idea, and that is what I was practicing for. The resolve was to make that idea true. I needed that idea to be true. But that really isn't what was happening. I think coming face to face with Rodney changed all that. It was this idea that Rodney was so direct about questioning everything. And this idea that you question everything. You don't have this sense that you know how the practice is and you know what you're supposed to do and you just go for it. You question everything. Pema Chodron says it this way. We have two alternatives. Either we question our beliefs or we don't. Either we accept our fixed versions of reality or we begin to challenge them. In Buddha's opinion, the train in staying open and curious. Oh, two train. I wonder, like, what's the train? In Buddha's opinion, two train in staying open and curious, to train in dissolving our assumptions and beliefs is the best use of our human lives. So this point of practice is to basically begin to chip away at this assumption and beliefs that we carry that we don't even consciously see. It's somewhere behind our actions, and we look for a way to challenge that, see it. Ajahn Suchito, he wrote a book on the paramis. And one of the ways that he talked about the paramis resolve or determination is what it does for all the other paramis. It says when it's conjoined, so it, resolve, is conjoined with other perfections, resolve serves to underline and strengthen them. One so determined to be generous, to refrain from doing harm, to let go of what needs to be relinquished, to discern and investigate, and to bring energy, patience, and truthfulness to one's practice. So once you join resolve with all the other paramis we've been working with, you actually strengthen the paramis. You begin to question into and look into the motivations and intentions behind these behaviors, actions, or desires that we have to even grow in our practice. It's not just, oh, generosity. It's beginning to question what we think generosity is. And by questioning our assumptions about what we think generosity is, we begin to strengthen that capacity within us. Not so much by making ourselves do something, but just by seeing into what's the possibility here. He said that the parami here of resolve is the foundation on which we stand in our practice. If our foundation or our intention is weak, then we will not have the resolve to be able to practice. If our foundation or our intention is strong, then we will have resolve. So if the intention, the motivation to practice is strong, then resolve is present. But in order to see whether your intention is strong or weak, you have to look at the view that you're holding towards practice. See, I thought my intention was strong. I started practicing in a closet. For some of you already know, I I didn't necessarily trust what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have a teacher. I just read a book. And so I would sit in the closet for fear that it might rub off on my boys, that they would be, have to worry about it. So I'm sitting in the closet doing something that I don't really understand what I'm doing, don't even know if I really agree, but this is the last straw. I have to do it. I have to do it. And I tried my best to create some image of what I thought, happiness, peaceful, with all this goodness that I thought I was supposed to get. That's what I thought it was. So Titos was saying that if you are looking for a quick fix, then your view is wrong. Your foundation is wrong, and it's a weak intention. I was looking for a quick fix. I'm trying to fix myself, and I think as soon as I get this meditation down, then I'm going to be good. But that, because the nature of transformation is actually a practice that takes a long time. It's a gradual shifting and turning. So if you're looking ahead at the end results and you're expecting those end results, your intention behind it, the motivation that you have, is going to get kind of weak. You can see, because it doesn't work. It doesn't, it won't go quick. There won't be this massive change and everything's going to be great overnight. And so your intention or your motivation begins to wear away at your ability to stick with the practice. And so it gets a little haphazard. Maybe you do it, maybe you don't. Maybe you pay attention, maybe you don't. It just kind of loses its force. But on the other hand, if you're interested in the experience, like exploring or questioning into the nature of the way things are, then your foundation will be strong. And you'll have all these opportunities to pay attention to whatever's happening. And all that feedback and information begins to give you a lot of capacity, and the foundation on which your practice stands is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Not so much because you have more will to do it, but because that interest in just seeing the arising of phenomena and the changing and shifting and challenging of the sort of your beliefs and assumption, it creates this resolve in seeing more and seeing more and seeing more. So an example of this is when I started coming towards, when I started coming to Sims, and Rodney and I would talk, and he's challenging some of my beliefs that I have. Not that he's challenging, I shouldn't say it like that, because that's really a misnomer. He wasn't challenging my beliefs, but listening to him was causing me to challenge a lot of my firmly held beliefs and assumptions about what this practice was going to be. And I remember, you know, thinking to myself when we were at Beth Shalom, this thing may not fix me at all. You know, like, I've been invested in this thing for over 10 years, and it may not even be the thing that's going to fix me. And I had all this kind of, what is the point then of all this quietness? Because the assumptions are beginning to leave. You're kind of coming into truthfulness is what's kind of happening. I'm coming into the truth of these wrong views about what practice is. I'm coming into the truth of it, and it's squaring up with me, but it's rubbing up against me. And you, as you might think, I started getting a lot of anxiety. Every time I would sit, every time I'd close my eyes, I would have all of this anxiety. And I couldn't really get rid of the anxiety. That's what I really was trying to do, was get back to the peace that I thought was supposed to be what the whole point of practice was. And I'm rubbing up against this assumption, and things are beginning to falter. And I can see why resolve comes now. Because in the midst of all this crumbling understanding, this fuzziness, that it seems like my practice is getting weaker because I don't really understand what I'm doing. I'm questioning everything. It has the appearance of not being a very strong practice because I don't have any surety about what it is. I don't have that sense of I'm trying to get to this and this is the right place to go and I'm going. I'm going to make it happen. I don't have that. It's all crumbling and feels weak and unsure. But I was interested in why that anxiety was here. What had happened? I was interested in what made it show up. I hated it and wanted it to go away, but I was interested in why was everything so different now. And I would watch, even if I could only watch for 2 seconds, what would happen? What would happen if I just stay for 2 seconds? And so even though in theory, I wasn't sitting 45 minutes hardcore, I was sitting maybe barely 2 minutes, probably closer to 30 seconds. And then I would stop and I would just sit there in the back of the room, you know, squirming and wiggling, trying to wish the time would hurry up and get by, looking to see if Rodney was looking at the clock in case he didn't notice. And then I would try again, a couple more minutes, trying to investigate into the nature of this anxiety. And I had more resolve during that period than I ever had in the 10 years that I sat solid thinking I knew where I was going. That resolve in that period was far stronger. So Chitra also said that if you don't have this interest in investigating, you can come up with this commitment to do something, but you really don't have the resolve. You have this commitment, you think you gotta show up, you're going through the motions, but you don't really have that firm foundation, that fuller foundation that is the backdrop of resolve. So it's that curiosity that began to drive me, wanting to understand what was this thing I called anxiety. And that is the thing that kept that resolve going. So you get this, this parami sort of helps us understand and see that there's an intention behind all of our actions, and we want to know what that is. What are the assumptions? What are the beliefs? And a lot of our initial beliefs begin to falter and change. The resolve is to stay with the practice close to you, even if everything about what you think this practice is beginning to fall apart and it's not really holding true. Your resolve is to continue to investigate that. Jack Kornfield said that to undertake a genuine spiritual path is not to avoid difficulties, but to learn the art of making mistakes wakefully, to bring them to the transformative power of the heart. So it's sort of like the mistakes we make, the things aren't working, the practice isn't what I thought it was. What exactly is all of this doing? The more sure we get, oh, I got it, I know what I'm doing, the weaker it is. The more like, what? I don't really know, but I'm gonna stay in there, better it is. So that kind of turns to this idea of our thinking. Because I never really thought of resolve as related to how I am thinking. But a lot of our understanding can come, a lot of our capacity to write our view in practice can come from paying attention to our thinking. And Joseph, in his book Mindfulness, I don't know if you guys have a copy of that book, but yeah, you should probably think about getting a copy. It's probably one of the most concise, and it's very simple, the way he explains mindfulness and all these various lists and things that we do. So he's talking about mindfulness, he's talking about resolve as part of the Eightfold Path, the right intention. And He calls it right intention or right thought. That's what this resolve is right thought. But before I get there, I want to just throw this one more comment in here from Matthew Ricard. He says, at each point in our lives, we're at a crossroads. I believe that. We are the fruit of our past, and we are the architects of our future. If you want to know your past, look at your present circumstances. If you want to know your future, look at what is in your mind. So at each point in our lives, we're at this crossroads. Because we are the fruit of our past, and we are the architects of our own future. So if you want to know your past, look at your present circumstances. You want to know what's coming from you, you look at where you are right now. And if you want to know where you're going, look at what's in your mind. That's what Joseph is pointing to, this idea of looking at our thoughts and seeing resolve by constantly paying attention to our thoughts. Basically, he says that there are three kind of right intentions in our practice. The three right intentions are this renunciation, this freedom from ill will, and this harmlessness. We sort of have those three. It's part of our virtues, part of the generosity, part of this fundamental tenet in our practice, whether you're Buddhist or not, this in Buddhism, those three: renunciation of the sensual desire, the pull of sensuality, not sexuality, but the sense doors, the pull of that, the looking for some kind of freedom from this ill will, irritation, anger, and doing no harm. So let me just read to you what he said on a couple of these. This is what he said about renunciation, why paying attention to our thoughts is so important. He said the importance of this step on the path, that's the Eightfold Path, is highlighted by one obvious but often overlooked truth. The great power of habit and habitual tendencies in the unfolding of our lives. The more often a particular thought arises in the mind, the more likely it will arise again. So given that our actions are conditioned on how we think about ourselves and the world, and that wholesome or unwholesome actions bring their respective results, we can begin to recognize the pivotal role thought plays on our path. It is thought. We gotta start paying attention to our addictive things, the things that we do continuously all the time, these behaviors, this thinking. It's almost like beginning to see that our thinking is action. You know, how many of you, I can think of a whole world of understanding and assumptions that as long as I didn't actually cuss that person out loud, it's pretty much okay. I can think it in my head and it's all good. I can think of all kinds of misery things about people that I'm mad at, but I don't say it. When I see them, I'm like, hi, how are you? Are you having a good day? Very nice and calm and kind. And we can get into this wrong belief that as long as it's in our head, it's okay, nobody knows, everything's good. That's sort of like me squaring up and looking like I'm a serious practitioner when Mama would walk in the room. But the rest of the time, I'm kind of laid back, like waiting for the 45 minutes to hurry up. It's sort of like that. So what Joseph is basically saying, from my perspective, is that we have to pay attention to our thinking as if our thinking is action. Because it is. It's just an act that's held in the head. So you pay attention to the thoughts that are leading to suffering and the thoughts that lead to wholesome, skillful, non-suffering, non-harming. We're going to look more into this in the practice side, but basically we're looking at our addictive, conditioned, habitual mind states. Some of these emotions that we regenerate all our lives, all day, every day, and beginning to pay attention to what exactly is going on here. Why is that irritation or that ill will or angst, why is it constantly showing up all the time in my life, in the way I do things? And beginning to pay attention to wanting to investigate the nature of it. The resolve is not, can I get rid of my anger? The resolve is, can I investigate some of these assumptions behind all this anger? So the way he says we deal with ill will is sort of with metta. The first one is with renunciation. The renunciation, looking at our habits, is how we begin to practice this renunciation, because we're paying attention to these habitual ways of responding, and you can begin to see that if you pull back just a little bit, that you might begin to uncover a whole bunch of dirt that needs to be swept out. The ill will aspect, we can look at it through metta. And he said that metta, because there's no expectation, metta is not dependent on external conditions, on people or ourselves being a certain way. For this reason, metta doesn't easily turn into disappointment, ill will, or jealousy, as love with desire and attachment so often does. What gives loving kindness its great expansive power is that in the end, when developed and practiced, it makes no distinction between beings. It's not a feeling limited to those closer to us. It basically, metta is how we begin to develop this understanding way of being that's free from this ill will. We get this freedom from this ill will. But to do that, you sort of have to think about all the people you are not going to send no metta to. All those people that you think, I'm not ready to send metta. I've always wondered why, when we do things like metta, or compassion or forgiveness, we always say that little catch thing, to the extent I am ready. So it's sort of like this little bypass. I don't really have to send metta to this person or forgiveness or hold this compassion because I'm not ready. And I'm not saying that you have to be ready, but I'm saying that if there's that impulse to pull back, then that is your practice right there. Not whether or not you send the metta, but the question of what is it investigating the thinking behind not wanting to send metta to someone or not wanting to have compassion for other people's circumstances. The last one is compassion. And in compassion, he says compassion, this is the working with your thoughts around harmlessness or doing no harm. You do that out of trying not to be cruel or beginning to see where your places of cruelty are. Now, I'm pretty much sure you, like me, we don't think we're going to do anything cruel. But I like the way Joseph does this. He's kind of sneaky in this way. He says compassion is the antidote to this great destructive power of mankind. Compassion is the strong wish of the mind and heart to alleviate all suffering. It opens our heart to the suffering that is there and overcomes our indifference. That sounds good. It's strong and deep feelings. It is the strong and deep feelings that's moved to act. That sounds good. So then he goes a little further and he says, it's worth investigating why such a beautiful and awesome, wholesome state is so difficult to practice. A careful examination might reveal even small and unnoticed moments of cruelty within ourselves. It's sort of like he's saying there, if you start noticing your thoughts, like with metta, you start questioning these places where you can't send metta, or these places where you don't have compassion, then that is the place that you might be able to see the thinking that is like the wrong thinking of cruelty or ill will. And that kind of your resolve is not on the idealistic view of, oh look, I don't do any harm, I'm not stepping on the ants, and I'm looking out for all the little worms and all the little plants, and I'm doing all this goodness and greatness. But in the back of our minds, we have all this ill will about certain people whose names we shall not be mentioning in the room. But there's a whole bunch of people we got a whole bunch of ill will, no compassion for. And so it's looking into those practices as to seeing why that is, what's going on there. Basically, Ajahn Chah says, anything that's troubling you, anything which is irritating you, that is your teacher. So that's about it. We're going to talk next week about, we'll just have a summary of this and talk about some of the implications of what all this means, some of the challenges that we would bump up against in relation to our resolve. This idea that we're going to resolve to be some beautiful people, wonderful people, but we're not going to challenge anything about the way we live currently, is going to kind of bump up against some of that. So you have to look over the course of the week and see how you're actually applying practice, how many of the places, how negative is your thinking, how limited is it that you are, or judgmental you can think about certain people and whether they deserve goodness or kindness. Or maybe even just question some of the assumptions or beliefs that we have about what you think practice is supposed to do for you. And if it hasn't been doing it yet, how come you're still in it? And begin to look into that. Like, what is that? And after we sort of spend some time, a couple of weeks with this, with just the nature of just trying to see if we could see resolve in reality in our own practice, not just kind of like a Dhamma talk, but can I see where it shows up in my own practice? Then we'll talk about some ways that we can practice with it towards the end of the month. So I think I want to end with this quote by Sharon Salzberg. She says, often we can achieve an even better result when we stumble yet are willing to start over, when we don't give up after a mistake, when something doesn't come easily but we throw ourselves into trying, when we're not afraid to appear less than perfectly polished. So let's just end with that and sit for a minute. Just like the way silence just shows up so nicely. Just seems like we can just take a moment and find it anytime. So But we're going to break that silence, see if anybody has any questions. Oh, Hafiz?
Yeah, and so why you put that and how, what the, to me the message in that was sort of like here, there's an inner world that you have access to, it just seems a little different than what you were talking about in terms of investigating.
So what I'm glad you actually mentioned that, Peter, because one thing I didn't ever mention, so I don't hardly ever look at my notes when I should be, but I wanted to share that much of resolve is from the inner world. It's not the, and sort of like when you think about it, my resolve in practice, the way I thought of it, was to make the outer world see me a certain way, make the outer world look a certain way, or make everything about what I thought my practice was supposed to do was to affect what I would consider the outer world. Whereas really resolve is more of an inward turning, noticing your own inward thoughts. It's not even like we have to say out loud, oh, this is what I'm thinking. These are my thoughts. I can't believe I'm thinking these things. It's having this capacity to begin to turn inward and thinking of our artistic expression from within and not so much, how do I look on the outside? Or what do I think about the world outside? So that's really the reason why I picked it, is more because it's this intentions, our assumptions, those are all internal things. And no one really knows that except for each of us individually. But it's, are we willing to go in there and discover the expression that we are outwardly showing the world, but are we willing to go in there and see that inward kind of world that's existing either in our thoughts or in our intentions and motivations behind it? So I'm glad you mentioned that. That's right.
So I'm trying to figure out why resolve is a separate parami and not just baked into each of the paramis themselves.
So the question is that it seems like resolve is inside each parami, and like it's in, you have to have resolve in generosity to practice the generosity or any of the other ones. So why is resolve a separate parami when it's kind of baked in each one? And I think if you think about the paramis and where they, how they move through, it's not like the other list. A lot of our list, you can kind of take a little bit of this and take a little bit of that and kind of practice haphazardly. But with these paramis, everybody seems to point to the fact that they are a rolling, developing thing. So you develop from generosity first and move into virtue and move into renunciation. It's sort of this movement. So if you think about it from that point of view, when you begin to get, you could have this resolve, which is true, in generosity. And you can have the resolve to watch our behaviors and watch our ethical conduct and to renounce, and you're moving into this truthfulness. When you get to this truthfulness, you start seeing some things that you're not, these are, you're getting a little bit more into the difficulty. Because if you remember when we talked about patience, it's like the turning towards the difficult. And that difficult is that truthfulness, we begin to see and practice how we're actually living out these paramis and what's actually going on in our world. It's not all pretty and rosy in our own ways of being. Even as practitioners, we still do a lot of harm. In this room, there's a lot of harm. And yet, when we see ourselves, we have a sense of, ah, we're all working towards these, you know, great intentions of doing no harm and freedom from ill will and renunciation. So it's almost like you need a parami, a perfection that says that this deep inner seeing of the challenging nature of being human is to have the resolve to keep looking at that. Because the next two turns are loving kindness and equanimity. And it's almost as if you have to have, it just feels like you should have a break that says, pay attention to the thinking and your intentions here as you turn towards loving kindness. And sometimes I think that if we just put loving kindness after truthfulness, from my own perspective, there could be a bit of smoothing over the rough edges. It's sort of like sometimes when we get to these really, really difficult places, and then we'll just like ply a little metta on it, so it gets all smooth and soft, and it's not so bad, I'm doing the best I can, everything's okay, and we kind of smooth it over. But if you have this place of resolve, and you put that in there first, before you turn to this kindness, then the intention and the assumption, motivation to stay with that difficulty that arises out of the turning aspect of patience and the truthfulness, that resolve to stick with this is what I think lends itself to that open heart that comes from metta and equanimity. So that's why I think that you'd have this separate perfection on resolve. It's almost like a separate perfection to remind us to constantly investigate the here and now. I think it'll show up also a little more when we start talking about the actual practices. Well, that's a good question. Yeah. Yes.
Because when we, what I've experienced is that when it gets down to getting traction on transformation, I have to understand the intention before, whether my intentions are conditioned or whether they're coming from a non-conditioned.
Yes. So the comment is that it seems really foundational, and that it's almost like a paraphrasing here, that you need to be able to see your intentions and your motivations behind things up front, and that it's foundational.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
That's right.
And you're right. You're right where it's beautiful. Your comment and Peter's comment, this idea that they're so foundational because that's what we're questioning. We're looking into the view of what it is that we're doing. And when we start talking about practice, that's exactly what everything points to. You can have a wrong view, like I did when I first started practicing, and you are going to follow that wrong view with resolve, and it's just going to lead to more wrong conduct. It's not going to be that you have some wrong view, but your resolve is going to make it all right. So basically the noticing that is what helps us turn from wrong view to right view. Yes, that's true. It puts that insight into insight meditation. And here's another reason why I think resolve comes now. It's because if you think about it, it's sort of where the rubber meets the road here. The loving kindness is the most beautiful aspect of this practice. It's so beautiful. And sometimes we treat it with such a haphazard kind of throwaway thing. It's like at a retreat when loving kindness is the 2 o'clock sit. That's what we're going to do, metta. After we've eaten and now we're digesting, and it's like, let's do metta. And of course, everybody in the room has this kind of like draggy, you're sleepy. But it's not really held out like the wisdom of breath practice. And yet, metta, if we are going to ever free this world, it is going to come through metta. It is not going to come through this wisdom of the paying attention to our breath. It's going to come through what Joseph is going to do. What Joseph talks about is this idea that you actually can have care and kindness for all beings, and you don't pick and choose which beings, that you can have a heart open enough that you can care about all beings. And he gives this example of His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, who's so tired, he's leaving from some convention. He's tired, he wants to go home, he's been gone, you know, he needs to go. And everybody in the hotel lined up to see him. And so he would not leave until he gave metta to every person in the line. He didn't know them. He could have easily, I mean, think of all the famous people. There'd be like, no, sorry, wish I could stay, but I'm really tired, I gotta go. But he didn't. He's like giving this metta to every person, from the dishwashers to the maids in the hotel. It doesn't matter who it is. He's standing there, gonna give metta to them. To have that kind of capacity, if we had that kind of capacity, if we didn't have this sense that we would pick and choose who we give capacity, we give care to, the world would be very, very different. But a lot of our difficulty comes because we have all these assumptions and motivations behind our behaviors that are unconscious. We can't see it. So unless we have that parami that's there, that perfection to intentionally look at our assumptions, our intentions, our thinking, and divide these thinkings up into these thoughts, into the ones that are leaning towards more suffering and the ones that are actually helping us be free, then you can turn into loving kindness, which comes next, and turn into equanimity and not really embrace it at the level we could embrace it if we turn towards it, with this resolve. So it's almost like I'm glad that it comes now when there's a bit of an edge to it, a bit of difficulty here after truthfulness, actually paying attention to what we're actually doing. So that's what I think. I mean, I don't know. I didn't actually develop these paramis in the order of it, but that's what it seems like. This would be the time that we would need to remind ourselves to stick with this difficulty and don't turn away from it and investigate it, chip at it and see, look for the things that we cannot see.
And I started thinking about tree roots and that sort of foundational, but then breadth to it. And then what I thought of, that like resolve has such a meaning in our world. And I was thinking, like, to me, the word resilience is it's actually maybe a, for me, a better word in there, because it means this ability to keep going and stay flexible to where the path leads.
I agree.
Resolve kind of, to me, has this intentionality, like I'm going to push through.
That's right.
No matter what. And resilience means I'm going to stick with it and follow the path where it leads.
That's right. And bend. Yeah. So the comment is that when she was thinking of resolve, and she was thinking originally after hearing the Pali definition of it, like a tree with its roots growing into the ground and its depths of spreading out and giving us some capacity. And then the more you think about it, the word that comes to her is resilience. I actually agree that resilience is not a word that we have always used, but it's such a common word now, and it has that same quality of resilience, that ability to be flexible and fluid and move and see beyond just whatever it is right now. And that's sort of what we're going to talk about in practice. You can see how once you start opening up the nature of the words, these words, then you can just begin to see how to step into it in the practice, in this idea that it's foundational, it's supportive of us for everything. And I do believe trees is a good example of that, because we're so, if you watch trees, there's a sense that they can hold so much, and they can bend, and they have this kind of resolved way about them to withstand whatever's showing up. You know, it's sort of like, I didn't know that trees talk to each other in their roots, right? I didn't know. And then somebody was telling me how they talk to each other in their root systems, and they're having all these conversations. And then I thought one day when we were hiking up in Issaquah, and they have a lot of deforestation, or whatever you call it, where they just have cut out half of the mountain. And I thought, oh my God, think of all the trees that were standing there hearing what was happening to all the other trees. You know, we would be freaking out. They may have been freaking out, I don't know. I didn't see any trees running, except in The Lord of the Rings. That's for the sci-fi people. But just think of having to hear or experience the suffering that would go on for all these trees. And you just hold that suffering. And so it's beginning, and a thought like that would have never entered my mind before this practice. There wouldn't have been that thought of paying attention that the trees would know about what happened to other trees. But that kind of, I think that kind of awareness of pain comes from our own ability to begin to hold pain and suffering. And then you can begin to see it all over the place. So, yeah, I like the word resilience. There's another word that we're going to talk about during the practice period called grit. That's another word. But we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But resilience is one, grit, things like that. Well, I think we probably should stop. And is this an announcement day? I can't remember. I don't think so. Okay, good. All right, well, I think we probably should just sit a second, just to let all the words and understanding take hold. I'll check and see if there's anybody that needs a ride home.